work session. First topic is compressed natural gas, clean energy, and city manager.
Well, we have three items on the agenda tonight, and two involve energy, and one about our sort of first major initiative, and having to do with our service ethic. So we're going to start with clean energy, compressed natural gas, and maybe do about 10, 15-minute presentations to get these three things done, but then leave plenty of time for Q&A afterwards. So with that, John?
Mr. Mayor, Council, Mr. Mathis asked me to look into compressed natural gas for our vehicles and a way to move toward that. I will just say compressed natural gas is about a dollar per gallon equivalent cheaper than regular fuel. The upfront costs about $40,000 on a large piece of equipment that we put into that vehicle, but the payback is about 4.2 years with that. We've got clean energy here tonight, Mr. Ken Nicholson and Scott Vizana, to present to you one of the options that we're looking at, and so I'd like to ask them to come to the podium and present what we have.
Thanks for having us this evening, guys. We'll definitely try to make this worth your while. I think what we have to offer, we can make it worth your while. A little bit about the company is how I'll start out tonight, talking about, we'll talk about the company, talk a little bit about CNG itself, talk about what we're doing in the area, in the region, and then talk about what we can do, what a partnership with the City of Columbia might look like. Clean Energy is a publicly traded company founded by Mr. T. Boone Pickens about 1996. We have 266 stations nationwide. Next year at this time, we expect to have about 350 stations. So we are a high-growth company, and we would like Columbia to be part of that growth. We do full design, operation, construction, build-out of compressed natural gas stations and liquefied natural gas stations. We are the largest company in the country that does this, by far, actually. as you can see, we have a marketing department. We're a vertically integrated company. With one phone call, you can basically build your station and operate it and maintain it for the life of the station. So we actually build the equipment that we install, so all warranties and everything remain intact. We focus on return-to-base fleets, high-volume consumption fleets, and that's why municipalities, transit groups, refuse vehicles, those are definite targets of ours. So if you go to the next slide, please. This is just because we don't, you know, the education level of CNG or compressed natural gas, not sure what everybody's level is, so we'll kind of start at the basics but keep moving pretty quick here. This is a typical clean energy station. It looks pretty much like a gas station, right? What we do is we compress the gas that's, and we're talking about natural gas here, we're not talking about propane, so we use the existing infrastructure. Typically, the pipelines have about 25 PSI going, you know, down in front of the road, in front of your property. And what we'll do is we'll bring that gas up to about 4,000 PSI and use it for transportation fuel. We sell it on a gasoline gallon equivalent, as John mentioned a second ago. So we're talking about oranges and oranges here. I don't know if some of you had experience with propane back in the day, but the heat content or the energy content was not the same, whereas compressed natural gas, we sell it on an energy equivalent basis. So next slide, please. So why do fleets focus or use CNG? The first one is obviously at the top for a reason. It's cheaper, cleaner, and domestic. These are the three that really hit home, in particular, the cheaper. The economics typically drive it, but the others are byproducts. Like John said, it's about a 50 cents. We're comfortable saying we're anywhere from 50 cents to $1.50 cheaper per gasoline gallon equivalent than gasoline or diesel. And it's about 30% cleaner greenhouse gases. It has less pollution than the greenhouse gases of diesel or gasoline. So cheaper, cleaner, and domestic. You guys might have heard that we have a 200-year supply of natural gas in the country right now. We're arguably the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, so it's silly not to use this when we have it here at home, which the other advantages kind of fall in line, abundant, proven, and it will help national security. But again, you know, why do fleets use CNG? Typically, our customers use it because it's cheaper. So next slide, please. In the region here, or in the area, in the state, some of you may know that the city of Kansas City currently uses CNG, or compressed natural gas. They have 5 existing natural gas stations right now. If you include the airport station, they have 6. If you've ever ridden on the red or blue buses when you've gone to the airport, those are compressed natural gas powered. We're in the process right now of contracting with the city of Kansas City. We expect that contract to be wrapped up either late this month or early next month to upgrade, operate, and maintain these stations for the city. And the initial cost or the investment from the city at that for that procedure is zero. We're going to invest our own capital to do this for them and remain as a partner for the next 10 years. So, and actually what it's going to amount to is they're going to have 3 new stations. They're going to have 3 new compressed natural gas stations, and one of those is going to have liquefied natural gas, which powers the over-the-road trucks. So out of the deal, they get 3 new stations, and we maintain the rest of theirs. So next slide, please. On the other side of the state in St. Louis, we're partnering with the airport authority there to put in a station across the street across I-70 from the airport terminal. If you've ever ridden on the Super Park parking shuttles in St. Louis, those are compressed natural gas as well. That is an operation that will remain behind the fence at the airport, but what we're going to do is open a station for the public and hopefully fuel all the rest of the parking shuttles, taxi cabs, and other fleets in the area. So we expect this station to be open next year at this time. So if you're filling this in here, we've got Kansas City on one side, St. Louis on the other. We've got stations on I-70 on both ends, hence why we're here to Columbia. So currently with these 2 stations in operation, you cannot get across the state typically on a tank of CNG. So what we need to do is fill in the gap. So next slide, please.
On this station, too, if you go back a second, you can have public-private stations that you saw the first slide was just a clean energy dispenser. This one with St. Louis and some other airport projects that we have, the CNG dispenser is going to be integrated with the gasoline and diesel, so you can have a combination of several different fuel types for public transportation. And the current shuttles and buses that operate in around the St. Louis airport, our product will be very similar to this one with the C-store and gasoline, diesel, and natural gas, all combination.
Next slide, please. So again, if you include Columbia in the big picture here, the network looks like this, and some of you may be familiar, the city of Springfield, Missouri, just has had several RFPs out to design and construct a CNG station down in Springfield. So their initial station is going to be all behind the fence for city vehicles, city, county vehicles, but what they want to ultimately do is market that station to the public as well. So this is just kind of a network of what we're working on or interested in the area, and of course we've included Columbia on this one. Eric, if you hit the next slide, you know, that leaves a pretty big void when you take away Columbia out of the middle here. It definitely affects the network. So that's just to give you an overall impact of what Columbia can mean to this network. Next slide, please, Eric. So this is just an example of how we would build the price of a gasoline gallon or a diesel gallon equivalent of compressed natural gas. Try not to make it too complicated, but you have the commodity. Natural gas is sold in an MMBTU, if you ever see it in the Wall Street Journal. What you can do to figure out how many gallons you can get out of that, a diesel gallon equivalent, you can get 7.2 diesel gallon equivalents out of an MMBTU. So if you divide that by, if you divide the MMBTU by the heat content in the diesel gallon, you get the commodity price. So you add that just to the regular taxes and the electricity to compress the gas. This is really where you arrive. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the point of this is a realistic, but just an example of where you might end up per gallon or per gallon equivalent. So it's pretty realistic. This works out from where you guys are spending, what you guys are spending for diesel. This equates to about a 93-cent saving per gallon. So, cent savings per gallon. So, just an example, depending on how much volume you have and the cost of diesel at the time, which is obviously expected to go up again, as everyone is seeing, even in the USA today, that savings continues to go up. Compressed natural gas or natural gas does not fluctuate like diesel does. So we'll pretty much stay flat here. If diesel spikes, we'll still be flat. Your savings goes up is usually how it works. So
next and if you're tax exempt, I mean that comes out of it. This is kind of an overall example. The compression fee, what that is our capital recovery if we're putting in $1 to $1.5 million station, plus the operation and maintenance. We're totally responsible for that station that you meet rolled out every day. So that $1.40, it could be certainly lower as the volume goes up. But this is a pretty good snapshot of how you build a CNG fuel price.
Mm-hmm. Next slide, please, sir. So this is a little tough to see on the screen here. I guess you guys can see it in front of you. But you want to go ahead and talk about that?
Yeah, it's an example of the 40-foot buses. Depending on how many you're going to procure year after year, this is a 12-year snapshot. On the bottom part is the fuel savings. The 20% match is about $44,000 of incremental difference. And so you got a little bit of a delta there to start out. And so as you add those buses in the first column, what you're going to spend is about $220,000 for the buses on the replacement from CNG versus diesel. But if you run that comparatively on 324 diesel gallons, dollars per gallon, versus CNG over year 1 to year 12, as you run in those buses, you can see where the fuel savings adds up the more buses that you use. And so that $220,000 investment, actually, you'll net 1.4, assuming the price of natural gas and assuming the price of diesel, which in 12 years, obviously, it's not going to be $3.24, but just as a snapshot running parallel, it's about $1.4 million savings, actually. So you don't really look at year one. You look at the life cycle of that bus, which is typically 10 to 12 years. And so that's how we run them parallel, and your savings is out totally from the fuel. And this is not capital out of your pocket to build a station. This is part of our capital to build a station. This is just pure savings on the fuel.
So if you look at the next slide, we've put together just a proposed or theoretical deployment schedule for compressed natural gas vehicles. And this was just taken from some of the historical data that you know, the vehicle acquisitions that the city has done in the past. So it's really not an aggressive approach to this, but it could potentially work for us and you guys at the same time to actually get the station in here. More vehicles, more saving, or more gallons, more savings is really what it equates to. But if you look at the first year, you can see the line 52 vehicles total will be purchased. So if you subtract the second year from the first year, you know we're only talking about first line with the 40-foot buses. We're talking purchased 3 buses, 30-foot buses, 1 bus, 1 cutaway shuttle. So we're really not talking about an aggressive schedule here. So if you want to turn the savings up, you know, what we might recommend is hold off on some vehicle acquisitions for a year or two while the station's being built, and then, you know, hit it all at once or pull some forward, put some back. So anyway, that's the example. We can talk about this more later, but again, it was based off of just what the city has done in the past or what we knew of the city's acquisition schedule in the past. Next slide, please, sir. So Ken alluded to the potential for additional revenue to the city, and in Kansas City we're doing this as well, and St. Louis will do this as well too. It's a revenue sharing opportunity where we provide royalties to the city or to the airport in St. Louis's case, and that's when our national relationships come into play. If we can drive additional volume to the station, if the city would be interested in that, and accept a royalty off of those sales. So, you know, a group like, let's say, MOEX or MODOT, you know, we've already contacted both of those groups and other groups in the area. Those two alone equate to 300,000 extra gallons of fuel that could go be dispensed from that station, with the city earning a royalty on each gallon. So that's why this slide is in here, and we have a basis with some of our national relationships. UPS is another one that I know is in the area. So there's definitely a basis for that. Plus, we have local business development managers assigned to the territory. I'm actually based in Kansas City, former resident of Columbia. So I know the area and know some of the fleets in the territory, and am expected to drive volume to the station. So if a public-private partnership was of interest to the city, you know, we definitely would be willing to discuss that. So, next slide, please. And we've pretty much touched on most of these, and it sounds like we'll do this presentation and maybe come back after the other presentation if there are questions. But you know, a few things to consider. The city is welcome to buy a station outright if they're in a position to do that. We would certainly entertain that. Or, as Ken mentioned, we can front the capital and work it that way. The vehicle replacement schedule, usually we'll work with the fleet department to figure out, you know, exactly what the city would be capable of. So, but again, this is mostly what we've talked about. I'd love to answer more questions if you guys have some after we're done and have the opportunity to.
Yeah, and in your packets, there's a lot more pictures and other kind of data that you can go through at your leisure. But we try to come in a picture of a snapshot of really what the big picture looks like, and it can be as large or small as your opportunity presents itself.
What's the lead time on having a station up and going?
Usually permitting is always the factor, but anywhere from 6 to 8 months, kind of ballpark, sooner in a lot of cases. And we just tap into the local utility line. Everything's above ground, and wherever the infrastructure is what we tap into. Our meter goes into the compressor and storage bottles. Everything's above ground.
Can you go back to slide 10, please? You get the estimated fuel consumption per bus for diesel at 9,000 gallons, and you get the same for the CNG. On your earlier picture with the lines connecting the cities, you said you needed one in Columbia because you couldn't get a bus from St. Louis to Kansas City. Did I understand that correctly?
Well, this is more of a snapshot of your return to base fleet. An example for a 40-foot bus based on the volumes that we were given to put some data together. The infrastructure part, we're also building 150 LNG stations around the country, and so we're connecting the dots from city to city.
I guess what I'm asking is, what is the difference between the diesel efficiency, as in distance per gallon, and the CNG?
Yeah. Great question. Gillig did a test at Altoona on a 40-foot Gillig bus, and it actually got better mileage and range than their counterpart diesel bus did. So,
and we can get you that
efficiency
report.
Is equivalent.
If I understood you, what you're talking about is to have a retail network, even though a particular vehicle could make the distance from St. Louis to Kansas City, that ideally you want to have a built-out retail network. Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. Yeah, from Kansas City to Columbia to St. Louis and some other pockets in around the region. Yes, sir.
Well, somebody like Moex would need to stop in the middle. They wouldn't be able to make it from one side to the other. Just the sheer capacity of the fuel.
Ah, that would be the other thing, because you're
9,000 gallons per year per bus.
But I guess that's where my question is, are we saving just in the initial cost of it, or in the amount that we will use?
Every gallon dispensed, I mean, if it's a dollar equivalent, I mean, once the payback's here, then that's a dollar savings per gallon. If that's the number.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that we're not going to use more gallons.
No. Same range.
That's where I'm
same
okay.
range.
All
right. Yeah, and it just depends on the tanks. I mean, if you need 250 miles in range, that's your route on a tank of diesel, whatever. The manufacturers will do exactly what your needs are for the range. Yeah. And these buses are OEM. I mean, if you buy a Gillig diesel, they can build a CNG right off the showroom. So this is not an upfit type of deal for the trash trucks or the buses. Light duty would be.
Now, are vehicles that are, this is a question for either you or for John, are vehicles that are fitted for natural gas, are they natural gas only, or are they dual fuel?
Do natural gas only.
Uh-huh. And presumably, okay, well, I'll ask the technical questions later. But.
Do you have any data on savings on maintenance costs?
We won a contract with DART, Dallas Area Rapid Transit. We're building four stations, over 700 buses and 200 paratransit vehicles. They did an extensive case study on the operation, the maintainability, sustainability, and they classified the operation and maintenance as a wash, meaning what you have to have for the new 2010 particular filters and urea versus a couple of other things for natural gas, it was a wash. It just came out for pure savings on diesel versus natural gas over a 12-year history.
John, let me ask you a question. You had 4.2 years to make it up. Our cost, though, is only $10,000 after the match. $10,000 more expensive on a natural gas. So after match, you know, our cost, you make it up in about a year, don't you? If it's at 9,000 gallons a year, saving almost a dollar a gallon.
Taking the total cost of the bus, and we only have to pay 80%.
I'm sorry?
We pay 80% on the bus. I mean, 20% on the bus.
Right.
Sorry.
So I'm just saying that we make it up in a little over a year then, right? When you
right.
when you talk about
we make it
our
up.
Part of it.
Yes.
Yeah, the focus should really, I mean, you do have a lot of light-duty vehicles, but really the focus should be on the high consumption, you know, the refuse and the transit is really the target here.
How is our ability to maintain this sort of fleet with our current facility for you? Are you going to have to?
Well, we'll have to change what we do, of course. I mean, some training and those kind of things, but it's no different than anything else.
Same number of people, probably, just different, just trained.
Just the difference in training and how you operate it.
The engine manufacturer is Cummins, who also builds, obviously, a good product in a diesel. Cummins Westport is a division of Cummins that does the natural gas. And so the training from them is there as well. They're very, very knowledgeable and have a year's experience on both sides of the engine.
So if our cost per bus is $10,000 a year for a bus more, and we're making up $8,000 a year, it sounds like a no-brainer.
Just wanted to bring it to you and let you know what we're looking at.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
There's no cost to us up front, like he said. And especially, you know, if we do a public-private where UPS can fill up at it and those kind of things, it's a better fit, I believe, for us than to have it just city-owned only.
Yeah, and, you know, it's convenient there's a cost savings here because this is a good thing to do for the environment and has a number of other advantages if it's contributing to a retail natural gas fleet. So it's great that the savings are in here.
Yeah,
that helps make it go.
If you look at one of the very last slides, even beyond in the back of the packet there, it's pretty detailed, but if you have a second to, and if you're interested to see the impact it will have on the emissions reduction, it's significant. In fact, we've almost single-handedly, with one station, cleaned up the port of Long Beach in California.
Yeah, Long Beach had particular problems, and I believe Kansas City also had a CMAQ requirement. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And we haven't had one, but that doesn't mean that it won't. It'll still mitigate the air quality. So.
Yeah, they usually don't loosen the criteria, so you only get closer to it.
Well, Scott and Ken, it's a very compelling presentation. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Game on Saturday.
You're not wearing a black and gold tie.
I'm not wearing red and blue.
We'll transition into a discussion of wind energy at this point.
Yes, in the spirit of clean energy, we have another clean energy project that we're bringing forward to you. This presentation is regarding the ordinance B-19-12 that's authorizing a power purchase agreement with Crystal Lake Wind 3 on tonight's agenda. This project started probably over a year ago for us, when we decided to take a look at our renewable requirements that we had, that we would issue an RFP for renewable energy. And at that time, this is basically what our renewable curve looked like. As you can see, we're running right a little bit above 5% renewable energy, which meets our 2013 requirement for renewable energy under the renewable energy ordinance. The way it stands right now, I think we're running right around 5.4%. That's detailed in our renewable energy report that's on the web right now in draft form. The reason that you'll see the red line trending up on this is because it's a percentage of load, and as our load increases, then so does our requirement for renewable energy. So if we stuck where we're at that time, we would be very close to the red line, and obviously there's a variable in there that's load associated with that. So go ahead. In February of 2011, we went out for a request for proposals. Some of the reasons we did that was we felt at the time wind was at a very favorable cost. There was a lot of market conditions and kind of a little bit of an oversupply, I think, of wind projects that had been encouraged by some federal incentives at the time. So we thought there was a good time to go out looking for a wind supply contract. In addition to that condition, we also were looking at this as a preparation for the 2018 requirement of 10% that you saw on our curve there. Certainly when you're doing power supply planning of this sort, it's hard to make jumps like that, so you have to do planning ahead of time and build into it. And that was one of the goals of this at the time, too. In addition, the Integrated Resource Plan has a recommendation that we investigate wind projects going forward to incorporate in our supply portfolio. As a result of this, NextEra responded to with an opportunity to participate in Crystal Lake 3 wind project. At that time, we went into negotiations with NextEra on this contract, and after quite a number of months of contract negotiations with NextEra, we did get to a final contract form that was approved by our Water and Light Advisory Board for this contract going forward. A little bit of a project overview with this. It is located in northern Iowa. It's the third phase of the Crystal Lake Wind Farm that's up there. It is owned and operated by NextEra Energy, which is one of the strongest renewable energy providers in the United States, I believe, at this time. And they are a subsidiary of Florida Power and Light. And I'm sure you guys have heard of Florida Power and Light, but they're probably one of the biggest investor-owned utilities in Florida at this time. There's a cost structure that I've detailed in this slide. It starts out at $42.50 per megawatt hour in this year, and then it increases to $43.50, $44.50, and then it levels out in 2015 at $45 per megawatt hour. The reason why we have this increasing or a slightly escalating price at the beginning of this contract is because there's some transmission constraints that this thing is governed on in the MISO system for the first few years of operation. MISO does have plans in there to alleviate these transmission constraints, but we suspect and MISO predicts that they will be a little limiting on the operation of this during certain times of the year. There's a number of different ways to deal with these transmission constraints. And as part of negotiations, this was the most forward, most straight way to handle the impact that these constraints would have on the facility. It was to just simply deduct a price in the beginning years of the contract until the transmission constraint was scheduled to be alleviated on the MISO system. It was a very favorable cost comparison, these numbers are. The slides going forward, I'm going to have some cost comparisons for you showing what we're looking at with our existing wind contract that's located in northwest Missouri and then some other intermittent contracts that we have on our system. And by intermittent, basically these are the resources that generate electricity only when the fuel is available. And for our system, that's wind and the photovoltaic generators. Go ahead. The first slide that I have here, while there's a lot of information on here, the points that I want to make is at the very last column is the megawatts produced per month. And a note to make out of this is the maximum or the best production months for these type of wind resources occurs in the spring and the fall. So you'll see the highest percentage numbers in the last column that correspond to spring and fall production, which is very consistent with wind generators. As far as calculating our annual cost, the other thing that's taken into account is the price of energy on the market when they generate. And if you correspond those across to the average monthly LNP price, you'll see that that corresponds to some of the lowest energy prices in the market when the wind resources are generating the most. So that basically impacts the cost for these facilities. The most important number on this page that I want to point out to you is the annual renewable cost per megawatt hour. And that's in the second to the last column at the bottom row. That's the $40.16. Now, this number is for our current wind resource that we are in contracts for right now, which is called the Bluegrass Ridge Wind Project. This is in Missouri. Going to the next slide. What we've put together here is the numbers for the same numbers using the same production type profiles with the numbers that we expect off the wind energy contract for the NextEra contract that we have in front of you right now. As you can see, though, once again, the most significant number down there is the annual renewable cost per megawatt hour. On this one, it's basically $20. So the annual cost for this is basically half of what our wind contract that we're operating off of right now that's up in Missouri. So I feel like we've made quite a step forward on the cost of wind energy that we're going to be incorporating into our profile for our energy supply with this NextEra contract for us.
And could I ask a quick question? How
yes.
long is our contract with the previous one?
Grass.
With what?
How long was the contract, or is the contract with the previous wind?
That's 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah, and so I'm making a guess. I didn't look into that, but I think it's probably about 4 or 5 years old.
I hate to be dense, but you're paying $45 a megawatt hour. How do you come up with a renewable cost of $20 a megawatt hour?
Well,
what are you subtracting off there?
What we're subtracting off is the market value of the energy, and this is the methodology that we use to calculate the rate impact of this resource to our customers, and that's in the renewable energy ordinance, is we have to calculate what the rate impact to this of this facility is to the rate-paying customer out there. So what we do is we calculate how much we're paying this above and beyond what we would be buying the energy for off the market. So that's what we call the renewable energy cost. In other words, if we weren't buying renewable energy, it would be zero. If we're buying it from this renewable resource, what's it costing us?
Let me ask the question I want to ask. I'll ask it now since we're talking about that. What's our blended cost for all energy? Megawatt hour?
It's somewhere in the mid-40s, about, I would say, $45 to $47 a megawatt hour for
okay.
Base load blended cost.
The reason I brought this up is that this is comparable, this
yes.
wind contract. And you mentioned that this will have a 0.75% increase in rates. And I don't really see the math. If you're getting the wind energy at the same cost as your current blended energy cost, I don't see how that raises the how that's passed on to the consumer.
There's two factors that go into this. One is I talked about the intermittent nature of this. It generates when it wants to. So we talked about the market value is we're obligated to buy the energy when it's generating for the contracted cost, right? So we don't get to dispatch it. It dispatches ourselves. Whether we need it to serve load or not, we're still buying it. So if it's the middle of the night and spring day when we don't need the energy, we're still buying it. The other thing is it's not a real apples-to-apples comparison because our baseload resources actually supply capacity, which is a significant piece. We don't get any capacity, which is the ability to serve our load with this type of a resource. So there's a little bit different nature in how it operates and the value that it presents to our system because we have to have enough capacity to serve all the load that we expect plus a 15% reserve margin. And this doesn't credit us for any of that. As just a comparison to the photovoltaic arrays that we're putting up right now, it is fairly comparable to that. We estimate that the photovoltaic arrays are going to be a little bit cheaper because of the time of year that they dispatch energy to our system. It more closely fits our load curves on this. So that's why you're going to see a little bit lower annual renewable cost per megawatt hour with what we're estimating for the photovoltaic energy than what we're getting, what we project out of the, out, out of the wind energy, and that's mainly due to the time of year that it's basically injecting energy into the market. Okay. A contract summary of what we're asking here is for a 20-year contract for Crystal Lake 3. Like I said, this is owned and operated by NextEra. The total of the contract is for 21 megawatts or 48,000 megawatt hours a year is our projection on this. It is connected to the MISO transmission system, which is a real advantage on transmission cost to be able to access delivery on the system. One of the details for this, what we're asking to do is to split this arrangement with the University of Missouri as a partnership on this. We're wanting to sign the 20-year obligation for the city, and then we would pass half of it through to the university through shorter-term contracts agreements on this. This slide and the last one basically show the details based upon the amount or on half the contract, which is the whole contract is 48,000 megawatt hours a year. We're showing this on the 24,000 megawatt hours a year that we would retain to serve or credit the City of Columbia's load that would go against our ordinance. A couple of points that I wanted to point out with this was, once again, the Bluegrass Ridge is on the top and the NextEra wind is on the bottom. As you'll see on this, basically for the same amount of rate impact, we're getting about twice as much megawatt hours that is delivered to our system. So once again, it just kind of points out the fact of how much of a better deal this wind contract is than the first one that we signed 4 or 5 years ago.
Excuse me, that right column, the sum of that right column is what must be under 3%. Is that correct?
That is correct. And you mentioned the 0.75. We're showing basically half of that would be coming through to the City of Columbia, and we would be passing half the benefits and the cost through to the university on this contract. The university agreement is going to be a series of short-term obligations where the city's obligation is going to be for the 20-year term of the contract on this. One more thing, just to note is the free power or the photovoltaic generated contract is very similar to the wind contract that we're doing. So those are kind of on an even cost keel to the city on this. So the final slide that I have here is showing with this contract on top of the slide you saw first, and then showing also rolling in and integrating to this what we think our photovoltaic generators are going to be doing over the next planning term that we showed here. That's kind of what we're looking at right now as a possibility of how this is going to affect our renewable energy requirements going forward. And you know, this certainly puts us at a point to where we feel comfortable with our requirements starting in 2013 when we go to 5%, and it's also serves as a good planning step to get prepared for our 2008 jump to 10% of our portfolio.
What are the university contracts? They're shorter term?
Yeah, we're in the process of putting those together right now. I think we're going to start out with a 1 year, and I think ultimately we'd probably like to run 2 or 3 years in length, but we will be bringing those back to you.
So we're committing for 20 years, and then they're going to commit for shorter terms?
Shorter terms. Our intention is going forward that we would have equal rights to terminate these contracts as they come up for renewal going forward.
The reason they're wanting short-term rates because of the biomass generating that's going to come online?
I don't think so.
Because energy is going to go up in cost. They have an opportunity to fix their cost for 20 years.
Yeah, but that's really a capacity resource for them also. Like I said, you have to watch out that you're not comparing resources that really serve different functions. They're under a mandate to be able to have a certain amount of renewable energy that they show to serve their load too, and this is one of the avenues that they would use to do that.
Forgive me if I missed this. Are we going to keep the Bluegrass contract?
Yes, we are. We are under contract for that. There's really no way to get out of it, even if we wanted to, and I'm not advocating that we would.
Right, thank you.
And I'm presuming that Bluegrass isn't making twice the money, but that for some reason due to technology or location or whatever that their cost is higher, which is why we contracted for that price. That must have been what it required at the time. That's a question.
There's really two reasons. One is, like I said, it's about 50% higher than the contract that we have in front of you tonight. There's really two reasons, and they're split fairly evenly. About 25% of the reason that's 50% higher is because it's just sheer the contract price is that much higher. I mean, through whatever reasons, whether it's just the market or the incentives or whatever put together, the price is higher. And the other reason is our wind energy contract in Missouri is outside of MISO. So we have fixed transmission costs that we have to roll into a variable amount of energy, and that hasn't benefited us very much. Yeah. The transmission cost going through MISO is a lot more tied to the energy delivered, and it's a cheaper rate for us. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things when we went out for the RFP. We gave preference to resources in MISO because we knew it was going to be significantly cheaper to be able to transmit on that system.
Right. Got it.
Why is this $45 a megawatt? And when I read the Department of Energy projecting wind is going to cost in 2016 $97, I mean, why is ours half that price?
We got a good deal.
Good negotiator?
Well, we did spend almost a year doing it. There were some changes in the MISO marketplace that both parties were a little uncomfortable with, and so it took quite a while to wade through all the details on this. My hope is that we hit it at a very good time, and this is going to pay off for us a lot more than it in the future than it is right now. But we do feel pretty good about this, which is one of the reasons that we are advocating going a little bit long on our ordinance at this time as a good planning measure for the future with this.
Very good. Any other questions?
Oh, I just want to say thank you. You've just continued to go down this road of finding good deals for renewable energy through the years and as you've taken over, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And in your renewable energy report, make sure you have that right column which shows the increase in cost, even though none of us understand how you're calculating it. We still want to see the numbers.
One of the things that we just started last year is we put the actual methodology that we're going to be using, because it is a little complicated on how we calculate the renewable rate impact. It's not that straightforward how you do it, and we've tried to detail exactly how we do that for the different resources. Obviously, we're going through our boards and the commissions with the annual renewable energy report that will be coming to you guys hopefully in a couple council meetings.
Thank you.
Thank you. To transition briefly into customer service, in the last budget, I sort of highlighted three core sort of innovations or initiatives I wanted to focus on this year. Probably the most important and quite honestly the most far-reaching is customer service. And, you know, say it how you want, it's about public service, it's about great public service. And no matter what business each department is in, this is the thing that crosses all the boundaries, right? This is the business we're in. We might deliver a slightly different service in each business unit, but this one area really does sort of raise all boats, so to speak, if we can get the tide to come in. So what we're going to present to you tonight is our status update, our work to date. Carol Rhodes has foolishly agreed to take this on for me, and she has done some great work, and I'm pleased that she'll walk us through it today.
Thank you. It's no secret customer service is something the city manager deeply cares about, and with his permission, I'm going to share an experience that he had with the department via motor vehicle. He needed to secure new tags for his car, and after five unsuccessful visits to the Department of Motor Vehicle, he became so frustrated that he went out and bought a new car. We do not want to be the Department of Motor Vehicle. And as Mike indicated, one of the city manager's wildly important goals identified in this year's budget is to create a customer-centered culture. What exactly does that mean? A customer-centered culture is a workplace environment in which all city employees recognize that the purpose of government is to provide a service to our customers and that we have an obligation to provide first-rate customer service. Coincidentally, the council in 2010 adopted a resolution establishing a vision and core values which states, We are committed to achieving excellence in what we value: customers, communication, integrity, teamwork, and resources. Unfortunately, the results of the citizen satisfaction survey with our customer service quality indicated 67%. And while this beats national and regional benchmarks, it is down 10 points from 2007. So we are faced with the challenge of transforming to an organizational culture that provides an intensive customer-centered culture, which means as city employees, we must understand that we are public servants and we are here to serve. It's the only reason we're here. We also must recognize the citizens are the center of city government. They are the stockholders of the city, they own the company, and we have an obligation to serve them as if we could lose their business and loyalty to the city. Although there are several individual departments within our government, the one unifying principle that binds us all together is customer service. So how do we get there? How do we execute a successful transformation to a customer-centered culture? The Journey to Excellence Committee and the Service Standards Team went to work, and I'll review the following timeline. In November of 2011, we executed a customer service trainer training contract with EdTrack. In December of 2011, staff working collaboratively with EdTrack developed citywide service standards and department-specific scenarios for training sessions. And I want to emphasize that the customer service training is not a canned approach. The service standards were developed by a service standards team comprised of 16 city employees from various departments throughout the city. The service standards team engaged in a process with the consultant in early December that included an explanation of the city's service culture framework, the mission, the core values, the service standards, the strategies to support this cultural change, training upper management, performance management tools, employee evaluation, new hire orientation, and citywide training. There were multiple groups that defined themes, and the service standards team worked in pairs, then quads, then eight in a group to develop these themes. After developing the themes, we went around the world to draft standards. And the themes were listed on the charts, small groups rotating among the room to develop the specifics under each of those themes. I'll emphasize also the customer service training is just one piece of a multi-step process toward a successful transformation. The Journey to Excellence Committee will continue to work on strategies which include the implementation of a contact center, pivotal to the city's strategy to create a customer-centered culture. Performance management, integrate service standards with performance evaluations. Create recognition strategies that reward exceptional service delivery. Develop strategies to support a customer-centered culture, training, empowerment, and coaching. And then how do we document and communicate our success stories? Last month, the Human Resources Director and myself interviewed Train the Trainer candidates, and these candidates were endorsed by the J2E committee. As a result, 20 city employees were selected to serve as Train the Trainer candidates, a diverse group of employees that are representative of the entire city organization. February 2012, here we are today, and we kicked off the train the trainer aspect of customer service training this morning. This morning's sessions included the 20 train the trainer candidates and 10 frontline employees. I am proud to report that survey results indicate 100% of the participants indicated they will be a greater asset to the organization and can put what they learned to immediate use. In addition, department heads and managers participated in training this afternoon, and 99% indicated their coaching skills and customer service skills will improve as a result of the training session. 200 employees will receive training by the end of the week. 200. The train the trainer training, let me just
say that fast.
Train the trainer training, TTT, those 20 employees participated in the actual training today. Tomorrow they will observe training as an observer, and then they will role play, and their presentation or their training delivery will be videotaped. And the following day, the consultant will provide feedback regarding their platform skills and their training abilities. The first training session for the successful train the trainer candidates, and I have 100% confidence that all of our candidates will be certified on Friday, is scheduled for February 22nd. And we have 10 sessions through the end of March, resulting in 520 employees being trained by the end of March. Adhering to this quarterly schedule, over 1,500 employees will be trained, plus those that we pick up in the new employee orientation that's held twice a month. Of course, continuous improvement of customer service never ends. It requires an ongoing commitment to improvement. Refresher training will be offered as needed. There is no built-in mechanism to measure customer service in government. Therefore, it is the responsibility of the organization to create specific, measurable service standards for all customer interactions. The City of Columbia has identified customer service standards into five themes: responsive, professional, helpful, knowledgeable, and friendly. I distributed a handout which indicates within each theme are service standards that are intentionally written to be applicable for all city employees, and all employees will be expected to integrate all of the service standards into their daily interactions within and outside the organization. To summarize, we are deeply committed to the city manager and city council's vision of achieving excellence in what we value. And the Journey to Excellence Committee is developing strategies to create a workplace environment that supports a customer-centered culture. The Train the Trainer candidates are an incredible, dedicated group of city employees who are committed to leading the way toward a customer-centered culture. In closing, I just want to share with you a quote sent to me by Jeannie Alexander, public information officer and Train the Trainer candidate. The quote reminded her of how we all should think when providing service to our customers. How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the old, sympathetic with the less fortunate, and tolerant of the weak, because someday in your life you will have been all of these.
Thank you for the presentation. Let me just say this. I really want to start this meeting on time. It's going to be a long meeting. We're going to have a lot of people here. So let's take a break and make sure we're back here at 7 o'clock.
Can I just say one thing? I just want to say that this all started in spring of 2010. Before everyone was on the council, except myself, I guess. And so I just want to applaud staff for continuing to go down that journey as we first looked at the Malcolm Baldrige Award. So we're making great progress. Thank you.
Thank you.